Okay, welcome back, everybody. As I introduced myself yesterday, my name is Shireen Gerges. I'm from a social and behavior change company called Common Thread. And we're just going to do this last sort of technical session with thanks to the London School for allowing us to crash their lectures a little bit. So thanks for giving us the opportunity. And because we're getting closer to action planning, this is the last sort of technical session before action planning, we're going to start being a little bit more active. So we're going to work a little bit more this session. This session is really going to be about vaccine hesitancy and minority groups, but it's a little bit beyond that to look at any vulnerable groups in your countries. So any groups that are vulnerable to not being immunized at the same level as the rest of the population. So I know Laos and Vietnam in particular wanted to understand sort of how to reach minority groups, but I hope that this will also be useful for the rest of you to understand who's most vulnerable, how to identify them, and to give you a framework to see who's being left out, why, and then how to design specific interventions for those that are being left out. And we're also going to think a little bit beyond hesitancy in this session to go to more towards demand generation and understanding what are all of the barriers that affect vulnerable populations from getting immunized. So by the end of this session, you'll, I hope, have some skills to design interventions that will resonate with your special population groups, whatever they may be. If they're ethnic minorities, if they're socioeconomically disadvantaged or otherwise disadvantaged, hopefully this will be relevant for all of you. Okay, so we're going to go through four main topics. We're going to understand sort of minority populations and how to identify them and what makes populations vulnerable. And then we're going to look at some data to understand how social data can help reveal certain vulnerabilities and what it can tell us. And then we're going to look at empathy. And this is something that Heidi touched on yesterday when she was talking about trust. Susan touched on it as well. And I really want to bring it out because it's particularly important when we're designing interventions or trying to understand vulnerable populations. And then the last part is going to be about design. So we're going to hopefully take all of this and think about how we can use that to design interventions in your own countries. So the first piece is around understanding minority groups and vulnerable populations. So why are minority groups important? So a lot of people or a lot of countries think, well, our coverage is 98%, or it's 90%, or we've reached community immunity or herd immunity. Why should we care about minority groups, the last 5% or 10% or whatever they may be? Well, a couple of reasons. The under-vaccination of minority groups can threaten overall vaccination goals like measles and polio. So we know that these outbreaks can occur in particularly vulnerable populations, and then they can create an outbreak and they can spread. So usually outbreaks start in communities that are vulnerable, both to immunization, but also to bigger health challenges as well. These groups also have particular vulnerabilities like language barriers, sanitation challenges, overcrowding that can start or generate an outbreak. And also because these groups are often a minority population or because they're often vulnerable in another way, whether that be language, whether that be gender, whether that be poverty, they're much more likely to be able to voice their concerns. So if they have some rights that are not being met, if they have services that they don't have access to, it's much more likely that either we don't know or it's not being addressed, or that it's not funded, or for whatever reason, it's much more likely that this group is not able to raise their voice and be at the same table as the rest of the population. And so if there is hesitancy or if there are demand issues, it's much more likely that it goes unnoticed and that it can grow and spread until it's too late and we have an outbreak or we have some sort of major distrust in the system that we weren't aware of. And then finally, and probably the most important, that ensuring equitable health and immunization access to all population groups is a humanitarian imperative. So even though we may have 95% coverage, and that may be enough to reach our public health goals, it's still a humanitarian imperative to understand why it's not 100% and why everybody doesn't have access to health systems. So there's two ways, well, there's a lot of ways that we can define vulnerability, but I've tried to pull out a very simple framework, and I hope that it captures some of the discussion that we've had in the last day or so. You could be vulnerable because you're hard to reach. And these are populations that could be in rural areas. They are geographically difficult to reach by distance or terrain. They have transient or nomadic movement, so they're mobile. They are being discriminated against by healthcare providers or the health system. They're not being reached by with recommendations from healthcare workers. There's war or conflict or any other sort of limitations to reach them. Okay, so this is what we're going to call hard-to-reach populations. Now, hard-to-vaccinate populations are populations that have access to these services, but they're difficult to vaccinate because of demand-side barriers like distrust, religious beliefs, lack of awareness, poverty, lack of time, or gender. Obviously, these two things interact. So you could be difficult, you could be distrusting the health system because you've had a bad experience or you've been discriminated against in the health system, right? So you could be both hard to vaccinate and hard to reach. And ethnic minorities can exist in either of these groups. So an ethnic minority can be geographically hard to reach, but also have distrust or also have lack of awareness, right? So there could be sort of multiple layers of vulnerability, or they could be in either one of these categories. So this is just a framework to help you see how to visualize this. I'm sorry it's a little bit small, but you can see here, this is supply. So we could have high supply and low demand, which is the most sort of challenging, which is hard to reach. I'm sorry, high supply and low demand, which is hard to vaccinate. Low supply and high demand is hard to reach. Where you have both low supply and low demand, you are hard to reach and hard to vaccinate. And that is often where ethnic minorities or the most vulnerable populations generally fall. So they have difficulty accessing health systems, or they're discriminated in some way, and then they also have some hesitancy or lack of knowledge, distrust, social norms, gender norms that are limiting their ability to access the vaccines, even if they had supply. Is that clear? I know that's a lot. Does anybody have questions on this? No? Okay, I'll keep going. So what I want to show you now is a case study, and it's pretty different from any of the countries you're coming from. It's actually from the United States. And it is a story about Michelle, who is an African-American. And in the United States, African-Americans are a vulnerable and sort of marginalized group. They are 10% of the population, but they have higher rates of poverty and lower socioeconomic status and lower health outcomes across the board. And even when we control for socioeconomic status, they still have lower health outcomes. So I want to show you this story. And I would like you to be taking notes individually while you're watching it to try to listen to why Michelle in this story, but more broadly, why African Americans? What is making them vulnerable? What is making them a marginalized group? Okay? Can you play it?
The world has got to change. I live in a community that was so prosperous with doctors and lawyers and politicians. Now we have drug dealers and corner stores that they don't sell anything but the wrong things. You cannot deny the impact that it has on people's health. I have been in West Baltimore my entire life. As far as money, my mother didn't have any money. I don't want to say she was poor. I'll say low income. Poor we were, though. In the 50s, we didn't have many choices as far as health care. The health care system then was limited. It was not good for us, and medicine costing so much that my family says sometimes, will I eat or will I pay for my medicine?
Which one do you, Mommy?
Oh, I just love my daughters when they come over and we get together and we cook and prepare meals together. It's healthy meals. When my oldest went to college, she came back with a different diet.
Now what happens is if I do a meatloaf, it's turkey instead of ground beef. You know, I make spaghetti, I make chili, stuff like that. It's with turkey and chicken. We grew up, we ate pork. We ate bacon, we ate a fresh shoulder, we ate pork chops. I did not think it was not healthy eating.
Right.
Because this is what we were accustomed to. I was in denial. I didn't want to face the fact that I was becoming a diabetic.
The impact is the fact that my family ended up with heart disease, emphysema, diabetes, cancer. My mother's sister, her daughter, died of diabetes. She was an amputee. My mother died of a massive heart attack. And
to address health disparities, we need to understand why they exist, that they're not due to one single factor. They're the result of policy decisions we make as a society. They're due to the environment, health education, insurance and access to care, access to healthy food, and stress. Those stresses are actually experienced disproportionately by people who are poor and people who have been historically disadvantaged in this society.
Solutions to these problems cannot just be medical. It's systemic, and that means everybody has to get involved.
If we want a nation to be strong, the people in that nation have to be healthy. They have to be well. If there's anything that we can do to stamp out disparities, we need to do it by any means necessary.
Hi, Ms. Simmons.
Hi, Daphne.
Here at East Baltimore Medical Center, most of the patients are underserved.
We need nice deep breaths getting up through your mouth.
Michelle is a terrific success story. There was actually a year where she had lost her job, and before she found a new one, she had no health insurance. And she still managed to buy her medicines out of pocket, paid out of pocket to come and have doctor visits. She was really invested in her own health. That's something that Dr. Cooper's research is looking at, why patients don't invest in their health like we wish they would.
Next thing on the agenda is the community update, so I'm going to turn...
Michelle joined our community advisory board in 2011. We provide education to the community about health and about research. We offer training programs for community health workers. We can be sure that we are meeting the needs of people appropriately and that we're not leaving out certain groups of people that have traditionally not been included in conversations related to health and health care. Our strong relationship with the community is just essential. There's no way that we could do what we're doing without their input. And my work is just one of many initiatives here at Hopkins.
Good to see you too.
Ms. Simmons is a great example of what happens when we get it right as clinicians and as an institution.
I am a fighter. I am a believer. I stand for what's right. And what's right is people's health. And I will never give up. As long as I have breath in my body.
One of the things that is so important is that people have what I call a liberated future. And it's hard to be liberated when you're not healthy. And when I say liberated, I mean freedom to be all that God meant for you to be. When we don't deal with disparities, then what we're doing is denying people an opportunity to give back to the world. And so we've got to fight it. We've got to fight it with everything we've got.
So I hope that you took some notes. So I want you to sort of keep thinking about that, but now get into pairs in your table and try to sort of compare notes and write down. You've got some cards and some markers on your table. So I want you to tell me, what are the specific barriers that you saw in Michelle's story that either prevented her from being healthy or prevented her from having access? And I want you to think really broad. So it could be environmental barriers. It could be cost barriers. It could be policy barriers. It could be social norm barriers. So I want you to think about her story And together, just write down two or three per group after you've compared notes, what you think the biggest barriers were to Michelle having access to healthcare, but maybe more broadly even African Americans. What's limiting to them? Heidi?
Good bits too about things that helped her.
We're gonna get into that in the next.
Okay, hold that space. Okay.
Yes, that's why this is such a great story, because there's a lot of opportunities in here as well, but we're gonna talk about that later. Okay, so you have like 5-10 minutes for this. Sorry, I should have specified as well. So one barrier per card.
Thank you.
Okay, we're just going to wrap up in 2 or 3 minutes, okay? Thank you. Okay, everybody, I know that you might not be finished, but we're going to keep talking about this story throughout this session. So we have a lot more to discuss. So I'm just going to ask the groups to... Okay, well, this was obviously a good discussion. You guys can't stop talking about it. I wish I could whistle. Okay. So we're going to report back, and then we're going to keep talking about this because it sounds like it's gotten you all very excited, which is great. Okay, so we're gonna try to move through this very quickly, and trust me, we'll come back to it. So what I want each group to do is tell us the barriers that they identified, and then put those barriers on the wall behind you, anywhere on the wall. Leah's going to help you put it up with tape. So we're going to start with this group who has lots of cards. Uzbekistan. So tell us the barriers that you identified, and then when you're done, put them on the wall and pass the microphone to the table behind you.
Okay, we identified lots of barriers. So one of them was a lack of knowledge on health practices and the link between diets and diseases. And we have connected it to cultural food and health practices. So, you know, the speaker was talking about how the family used to eat a lot of pork and fat food. Yeah, so they were not aware of the health consequences that this may have. So these two are interconnected for us.
Okay, so you said it was knowledge and awareness and social and cultural norms, right?
Yeah. Then we have, obviously, drugs is a big issue, and it plays into lots of other issues, so we didn't really know how to talk about it. We formulated it as a policy gaps on drugs, which... You know, as anyone who worked with HIV drugs, et cetera, knows that this is a very intersectional issue. So That's the shortest way we could formulate it. Mm-hmm. Then we have obviously high cost of healthcare and limited access for low-income people, population. One of the most important ones, I think, is the lack of community engagement in decision making. They mentioned that they were not included in the conversation about their health. And the last one, again, we have noticed that this was mentioned many times, stress. So I don't know if this is a consequence of all these barriers or it plays into them. I think it's also interconnected. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Great. That's a great job. Thank you so much. Can you just pass to Georgia and Vietnam? What were your barriers that you identified?
Let me present from behalf of our table. So we have come up with four main barriers, which are very much interconnected. So economic condition is there. I mean, grounded, we think it's a very basic and main barrier, which this population group suffered in the last century. So she's talking about her younger years, where the whole population, probably this group, was in a bad economic condition, and because of that, they suffered from different barriers. Like, for example, the government probably did not support, did not subsidize their health services because she was deprived of their health insurance, and because of that, she had poor access to the drugs, and she had to pay for the drugs out of pocket, or sometimes she has to choose between whether to buy food or drugs. So it's very, very poor condition. Because of that, they were deprived of health education, and so that led it to a poor and inappropriate health diet and healthy lifestyle that led to the chronic conditions. Environmental, overall environment was, conducive to that, the bad or not healthy lifestyle, because the whole environment was living in the same way, mm-hmm.
Yeah,
in the
absolutely.
Community. So, yeah. She didn't have a way, she didn't see any good examples in the environment.
Exactly, yeah, that's great. Thank you. If you can just put your cards on the wall while we move to this group here, Lau. Thanks.
Hello. For our group, look at for the video, we can summarize the first the knowledge. And awareness, and also behavior like lifestyle to living and not change because this is related to the knowledge, and also look we see the low income in the and cost. Barrier to access. I think this we get the big point from the video we summarize.
Poverty.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Okay, great. Thank you so much, Lau. So if you can put your cards on the wall. Thank you. Okay, last group, Armenia and Ghana.
Thank you very much. Ghana, we have identified three important elements. The low income, of course, the low income, followed by the poor access to healthcare, partly due to the low income and also the limited health system in which they are operating. A behavior also as a poor diet and nutrition that was really leading to non-communicable diseases in the area. Mm-hmm. All these things were affecting the healthcare.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That's great. You can put your cards on the wall.
From our site, we identified also three barriers. First one, poverty, because she mentioned in video that she didn't have money for good health services. She was paying. She was investing for her life. And she didn't have any chance to look for good services, best services. So the first one, poverty. Next one, cultural barriers. So their family, African Americans, they moved to United States, maybe. There is no information in the video, but she was telling that her family was struggling with diseases, various diseases. They don't have opportunity to choose best food, best for education, and so on. And the only way we could find any solution in society. Services to use for education and other. And the next, the last one, social, it's a collecting wording, social environmental. I mean, all the barriers she has faced during her life, it can be just summarized in one word that is social environmental poverty. Demographic, cultural, as an umbrella, social environmental barriers.
Okay, thank you so much. Okay, so you guys were definitely paying attention in the story, so that's great. So some of the things that you've picked up on. Are really good. So I saw a lot of people say socioeconomic. And when we say socioeconomic barrier, that's things like age. It could be ethnicity. So in this case, African American. So she had systematic vulnerabilities, right? She talked about, for example, her grandmother dying of heart disease, her mother dying early, people in her family dying sort of very early and through diseases. So if you think about the effect of that, what does that do? That means she probably grew up without both parents or without one parent. That contributed to their poverty and her support system and her knowledge and awareness, right? So there are generational impacts that we can look at with socioeconomic. The other thing that people sort of talked about were policies. So in terms of access to healthcare, even though she seemed geographically close to healthcare, she talked about not having insurance, right? And so she couldn't afford certain healthcare. So these are policies that are impacting her access to healthcare. We talked about environmental, and that manifests in a lot of different ways. One is drug dealers around. So it's not a healthy environment, right? So maybe that affects her ability to want to go outside. Maybe that affects her mobility. Maybe there are security concerns. The corner stores don't sell healthy food. So her access or the easy availability of access to food is not supportive. And then her environment around her and her family and her community. I think if DT mentioned it, she doesn't really see good role models. But we also saw when her daughters came back from school, what that did. And we're going to talk about that in a minute, okay? So environmental factors play a really important role. We spoke about ethnicity, so it's sort of linked to socioeconomic. access to services. So we don't know how far she was from the health services, but it seemed like there were times where she didn't have access to services. But then when she did have access to services, we're going to talk about maybe some enabling things that we saw in the video to help draw her in to those services and help keep her there. Age didn't really come up, but it could be under socioeconomic. But she was sort of older, right? She was a grandmother. And so she might not have access to information or to services in the same way that maybe things are digitized. Maybe she doesn't know how to access digitized information. Maybe she has mobility issues because of her age. So it's just something to think about. It wasn't so clear in this video, but it's just an important barrier. And then we talked about the social and the cultural norms that I think is clear. And then gender. Now, again, she was a very empowered woman, but imagine if she was a single mother who wasn't empowered or who spoke a different language or who was, didn't have a support network around her. And what is her gender? What position does her gender place her in? So that's another important thing to look at. Okay, so we've got these barriers up, and we're going to come back to those, but these are sort of foundational root causes of barriers, okay? Now, what are some positive things that you saw in the video? So what were some opportunities that helped Michelle overcome these barriers?
I think community engagement, community help supported her to overcome these challenges.
Can you be more specific? What did you see that was,
Education, it was education, information sharing, awareness.
Okay. Can anybody else be really specific about what you saw in the video that helped her overcome those barriers? I know you're now forgetting the story a little bit. There's a lot in there, but.
Well, it seemed like there was infrastructure improvement. So the Hopkins Community Health Center, or whatever it was called, was now available, this particular program that was perhaps tailored for people, locals that would maybe otherwise not be able to tap into the Hopkins health infrastructure, but they were taking, you know, very deliberate actions to enable the local communities to benefit from the healthcare.
So they were inviting local communities to participate in their programs, right? Great. Anybody else? Where was she at the end of the video? Do you remember when she was sitting there? She was in church, right? So she had a community structure in church where presumably she was active, right? Because we saw her there. What else did we see? Sorry? Her family was around her and giving her positive information. So one of the most important things that I would like to emphasize is the community advisory board that she was a part of. So we saw her in that meeting, right? And she said, I was part of the community advisory board. And they allow people like me to design health services so that I can access them. So not only was she participating in a community structure, but she was helping design and change the health services so that they were more beneficial to her needs and people of her community's needs. And that's a really, really important point. And we'll come back to that. Okay, so we've just sort of did a little exercise here that starts identifying barriers. And whether you know it or not, what you've started to do is think about social data. And what is the kind of data that we look at to help us understand vulnerability and understand barriers to accessing immunization or accessing healthcare. So most of you are in national ministries, and you're probably looking at coverage data all the time, right? And that is your main metric of success. How many children got immunized? What is our coverage rates? So what I want to talk about is why that's not enough. So coverage tells you who was vaccinated, what age groups they were vaccinated, and what your coverage is. But what it doesn't tell you is who are the hard to reach or the hard to vaccinate children beyond age and sex. So what you probably have in coverage data is age and sex, but you may or may not have, do you have ethnicity in coverage data in your countries?
In coverage data in Armenia, we don't have this ethnicity reasons for refusals, but we have another form, another special form, justifying why the refusals come from, what are the reasons, gender, and ethnicity as well. Yeah. But this is not included in the coverage data.
But you have this in other
sources. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, and I also want to just mention an important point mentioned by Armenia is a lot of countries have refusal data, but they don't necessarily have other reasons for missed children. So refusal is a very specific reason. It's I'm saying no to the vaccination. But children may be vaccinated because they're hesitant. They may delay, or they may skip, or they may do one vaccine and not all of them. And so refusals is a very hard sort of hesitancy issue, but you may be missing children who are missed because of other reasons. So coverage data also doesn't tell us habitat. Where are they living? What we often know is geography. So they're in this district or they're in this region. But we don't know, is that a slum? Is that a multifamily dwelling? Is that an informal settlement? So coverage data doesn't tell us, unless you sort of put it on GIS mapping, maybe you can get that information. But generally speaking, hard coverage data doesn't give us this information, which is really important to understand the groups that we're interested in. The barriers, so why are they not getting immunized? So all of these reasons that you've just identified here, coverage data does not tell us that. And so these barriers are sort of, some of them are sort of basic and superficial knowledge and awareness, but the root causes of that might be poverty. The root causes of that might be social norms or might be discrimination for generations. So we also, it doesn't tell us sort of root causes, which are trust issues, social norms, cultural norms. And then it also doesn't tell us, are we missing any additional information? What else do we need to know about why we're missing 5 or 10 or 20% of our population? So what social data helps us do is understand more deeply who our populations that are vulnerable are. And then it can also help us apply that data. So how can we best engage and reach specific parents? What are their community structures? Where do they get their information from? What languages do they speak? What are some mechanisms that we can use to reach them and allow and motivate them? So it also helps us apply our interventions, and then it also helps us to monitor. So we can see, are we influencing people's beliefs? Are we influencing their intentions? And then the coverage data at the end of the line sort of comes in and says, okay, have we changed their behavior? Is coverage increasing? So it's really important to put these two pieces together. Coverage data or epi data or surveillance data, whatever you're using, or all of them, together with social data. And oftentimes, this is the piece that usually gets left out. So good social data is, you know, governments often think we don't have money to invest in social data. We have monitoring systems, we have national systems, and social data, which are more surveys or one-off surveys, are too expensive. But actually, good social data can save you money. And it can save you money by reducing investments in nationwide and interventions that will not meet specific needs. So your public health interventions might make sense for 90% of the population, but if you implement them in a population that is very specific or vulnerable, it's not going to work. Or it may not work as effectively. And so you might not want to invest that same strategy in a population or in an area where it's not going to work. And so you can save money by changing your strategy in those particular areas. It can help you segment those different groups that need different strategies. So it can help you see, where do I need to do this strategy, or where do I need to do that strategy? So again, you're not wasting resources. And then, you know, it's the same message. It can help you tailor interventions based on who is the most impactful influencer, for example, who is the most trusted source, You know, how do these vulnerable communities want to receive their health services? Do I need to put a woman in the health clinic versus, you know, the rest of the country? It could be either a man or a woman. So it really helps you design and tailor your strategies so that you don't waste money. So I'm going to just talk about the polio case study. Even though polio has been eradicated in most of the world or eliminated in most of the world, but it's a really good example of how the program used social data to really understand who those last 5 or 10% of the population was. And not many programs have this level of data, but we're starting to realize that this should not be the exception, that this really should be the standard to which all immunization programs are starting to think. Okay, so in 2017, we thought, I say we because, I was in the polio program for many, many years, so it's hard to still say they, but they thought that polio was almost eradicated. And by 2017, the number of cases was very, very minimal. It was something like 15 cases in the whole world. And all of the cases were in these three countries. It was in Nigeria, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. And that blue line up there is the percentage of missed children, and the red lines are the refusal cases. So you can see in Nigeria, you know, coverage was 98%. In Pakistan, it was like 94%, and in Afghanistan, it was 96%. So in an immunization program, we've reached our target. We're over 94, 95% coverage. We thought we were done. But there were large numbers of inaccessible populations suspected of harboring and spreading the poliovirus. These were geographically inaccessible populations due to conflict and insecurity. So if you remember the framework we talked about earlier, these would be hard to reach. Okay, they were in a conflict-affected area. They didn't have systematic access to health services. But there were also some parts of the population who had low demand for multiple doses. So we're going to classify these as hard to vaccinate. Okay, now how did we know that they had low demand? Because the coverage was really, really high. So we started asking people, do you think that paralysis is curable? In Nigeria, 45% of people thought that polio was curable. In Pakistan, it was 16%. In Afghanistan, it was 6%. Now, in Nigeria, this is just after they had polio came back after they thought that they had eliminated it. This is the year after polio had come back. Do you believe in negative rumors? 6% in Nigeria said yes, 23% in Pakistan said yes, and 16% in Afghanistan said yes. Do you think that your neighbors fully support giving OPV? Only 38% said they do not think that their neighbors fully support. 44% said so in Pakistan, and 63% in Afghanistan. So even though the coverage was high, this showed us that there were fractures under the surface, that if we weren't careful, there was either more refusal or more hesitancy than we expected, that coverage was very vulnerable to go down, and we had groups that were hard to reach, so they were inaccessible. So if you combine the hard to reach, you know, children that we weren't able to access, with the hard to vaccinate, you start to get a perfect storm for something that could be an outbreak. And this is what was happening in 2017. But most epidemiologists, and this is where your role is so important, sitting in ministries of health, most epidemiologists don't look at this data. And if you put it in front of them, they dismiss it. They say, we don't care. Our coverage numbers are high, and this isn't really going to impact coverage. But exactly what we saw is that this started to impact coverage.
I'm just wondering, most epidemiologists sitting at the national level and looking the national data, they don't have chance to go the subnational community data or not, because community coverage, subnational coverage can show the hard reach areas, low vaccination coverage as well, even not having the social data.
Sorry, can you repeat your question?
I'm saying that national data is very showing a very high coverage. But subnational or community coverage data can show the low coverage areas and populations which are not served.
Yes. So you always want to start with coverage data, right? That's your first point of departure because that shows you where you have gaps in coverage. But then to understand why you have gaps in coverage, then you need more social data. You need to understand why is this group lower coverage than another group. You may think it's because of access issues or say, you know, we have poor access in this area or poor quality. But 95% of the time, there's a mix of access and demand. Or the two are influencing each other very heavily. And actually, if you address your service quality issues first, you know, you can probably knock out 50% of your coverage problems. So the key is to sort of keep changing your interventions, but always keep your finger on the pulse of social sentiment. So always be listening, because even if you think coverage is high today, it may not stay high tomorrow. And as we talked about rumor management and risk, if you get ahead of it, it's much quicker, it's cheaper, it's easier than if you're on the back foot trying to respond to a crisis. Yeah? Please.
Thank you very much. And I think what we should be stressing on is that though at a certain level, you feel that the coverage data is very good, you should go due to disaggregate the data to the community level. Yes. Because if it is even 98% at the national level or 98% at the regional level, by all means, there are some communities who might have 40%. And when you go into those communities, that is where the social intervention will be important. Because you ask, but why are they having problems? So are there, now we look at a 2x2 table, how to reach, how to vaccinate. So you begin to look at the behavior at that community level.
Exactly.
That is it. Thank you.
That's great. Thank you. Lauren?
Is this?
Yes. Thank you very much for the presentation. I think we've been listening with great interest because, of course, Laos has quite a lot of ethnic groups that can be difficult to reach. And the comment that I wanted to make is kind of drawing together what you're speaking about and what we spoke about just prior around the healthcare worker hesitancy. And I'm not sure that it's necessarily healthcare worker hesitancy or healthcare worker frustration, if that's a thing. I don't know if that's a technical term. But the reason I'm mentioning it is, you know, Laos has had a pretty significant measles outbreak this year, which has been a pretty big setback because we were really feeling confidently on the road towards elimination. And it started in our own backyards, in the capital, in a district of the capital, and community in a district that had been kind of systematically overlooked by healthcare workers because there was such vaccine hesitancy in that community, and it was an ethnic group. And so I'm wondering, how do you approach that particular situation where healthcare workers have been met with so little, I don't know, interest or enthusiasm by a community where they just stop going?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not even enough to expect that those community members to bring their children to healthcare, to the health center, the health facilities. They're actually, you know, able to do outreach potentially, but they're not actually really that welcomed in that community, and so they've just stopped going and stopped trying.
Yeah.
So I'm just curious if you have any advice or insight, because we know a lot of the social context and the reasons why, but that doesn't necessarily give you the answers of how to address it.
Yeah, and we're going to get to the answers of how to address it, but that's a really important point, and I think Heidi spoke about this in her session as well, that the healthcare workers are part of the community. And so you need to design interventions for healthcare workers just like you would design behavioral interventions for the community, because, you know, a good community outreach system will be very local. And so if there are rumors in a community, or if there's mistrust, or if there is poor supervision or remuneration or training or whatever, You know, that's a dynamic relationship between the healthcare worker and the community. If the healthcare worker doesn't know the real facts or the real information, they can't relay that to the community. And the community may not trust that health worker if they come to their door and they're not knowledgeable. So I want to touch on that because we also have some data on trust of healthcare workers and how important that is. And I know I'm not answering your question yet, but I will. Okay, so trust for vaccinators was significantly lower in certain areas and among certain populations. So there are certain areas in all of these countries that we characterize as most vulnerable. Sort of arguably, there's a lot of the country that's vulnerable, but there were most vulnerable. So in Pakistan, the sort of northern regions where it was largely Taliban controlled and still is, which is Fatah, which is the tribal areas, compared to the rest of the country, their trust for their polio vaccinators was 26% compared to the rest of the country. The internally displaced populations who were coming over the border from Afghanistan, their trust was 34%. In Nigeria and Borno, where we had a lot of Boko Haram and a lot of conflict, their trust was 48% compared to 70%. In southern Afghanistan, which is all Taliban-controlled compared to the rest of the country, unfortunately, we didn't do data in the rest of the country, but it was 40%, so still pretty low. And the point that this shows is that trust for the health system can never be delinked from what's going on in the environment. So we just spoke about all the environmental issues, right? So what's going on in that environment? There's conflict. There's people going around who are unknown to the community. So I don't know if this healthcare worker is here to help me or if they're not here to help me because there's different groups and I don't know which side they might be on. I might be a mother who's very religious. My husband has told me, don't open the door for strangers. And now a man is coming to my door and wants to vaccinate my children, somebody I've never seen before. I'm not going to open the door and vaccinate my children. So there's trust issues, and you know, as Lauren has just said, that healthcare worker who's just trying to do their job may be met with distrust, may be met with, you know, there's a lot of stories about healthcare workers being harassed. You know, the most extreme example, we've seen healthcare workers be shot and killed in many contexts around the world, especially in areas of conflict, like in Syria, in Pakistan, in Yemen. And so that level of distrust can be so severe that people think that healthcare workers are literally, you know, attacking them, as we saw in Ebola as well. So I think, to your point, it's important to understand the context of which these healthcare workers are working within and to try to design their services in a way that allow them to overcome that environmental distrust or that environmental perception for when they're meeting their constituents. Is that clear? So I'm going to show you one more piece of data. So and then just to say, you know, demand or acceptance, it's not steady, right? So it can be very, very fluctuating, which is my point to you. So very high demand today could change tomorrow. So, for example, caregivers who think a disease is curable, we're seeing it all over the world that people don't see measles so much anymore. They don't see tuberculosis anymore. They think they're not at risk. So I may be, you know, pro-vaccine, but I'm going to sort of be a little bit more passive about it. You know, I might not make that extra effort to go and get my kids vaccinated. I'm starting to believe some negative rumors. Okay, that's going to erode my acceptance maybe a little bit more. I don't think giving vaccine is socially acceptable. Nobody in my circle is giving their kids vaccination. And so why am I doing something that's really different than everybody else? I must be the one that's doing something wrong. That's going to erode my trust a little bit more. And then, you know, it's just not a priority for me anymore. I haven't given my kids vaccines in 2 years. They haven't gotten measles. They haven't been sick. It's fine. So I've now suddenly become a refuser. So something that starts out very, very innocently and very rationally can slip. And this is the importance of always keeping your finger on the pulse and understanding where people are and where to start intervening. And then this fatigue. So in polio, it was campaign fatigue. But it could also be immunization fatigue. You know, the more we talk about vaccine hesitancy, the more we talk about resistance, people maybe get tired of it and just switch off. So achieving full protection against disease requires going beyond passive acceptance to a norm of active demand. So it's not enough that people sort of just passively don't have an opinion or they're neutral about vaccination, but that they're resilient, that they're actively demanding vaccines. So again, you know, if you go through all the social data that we learned about, you can see all the data that it showed us. So we knew that, you know, people were mobile. They were living in conflict. We knew that they were in urban slums. We knew that they distrusted health workers. They were misinformed because their neighbors, they believed that their neighbors didn't support vaccination, but they did. Everybody was vaccinating their children, but they thought that nobody else was. So you can see a really clear mix of hard to reach and hard to vaccinate, or one of the other. Okay, so what do we do with all this information? Back to Lauren's point. What do we do with, okay, we know there's no knowledge, there's limited awareness, we know there's limited trust. Susan showed this, a simpler version of this yesterday, and this is the caregiver's journey. And basically what this shows is all of the different kind of stops. Imagine this like a train route. So you're taking the train and you're going to the health clinic. And these are all the stops that a person goes through consciously or subconsciously. And it's the same for a healthcare worker. Okay, they're also going through this same journey. And these are not linear. So everybody has a different journey. Okay, so I might have really low knowledge and awareness, but my intention is really high because my grandmother got us vaccinated and generations before me vaccinated their children. And so my intention is high, and I'm just going to go straight to the point of service because it's reflexive. It's what I've done for decades. It's what my family has done. But if you ask me why I'm vaccinating, I don't know. I don't know what diseases I'm vaccinating against, and I don't know what my children are at risk for. I just know it's a good thing, and I'm going to do it. Or it could be that my intention is low, and I'm in the health clinic for something totally different. My child has a fever, and I've just gone to get my child looked at. But because the healthcare worker at the point of service has said, have you gotten your vaccines? I have all of them here. It's going to be really quick. Let's get your child vaccinated. My intention was low. My preparation was low. But I got vaccinated at the point of service. And so in this journey, it becomes really important for the after service part to work. So we got somebody at the point of service. What happens when they leave? Or is there a reminder system? Is there follow-up? Do we know who that family is? Okay, so different parts of this journey are going to be really important for different contexts and different population groups. So what I want you to do really quick is just kind of go to back to this board of barriers and try to organize them based on where you think they might be on this journey. So we have knowledge and awareness, trust, intention, preparation, cost and effort, point of service, after service. I hope that the categories are self-explanatory, but if you don't understand them, does anybody have any questions? Okay, we're running out of time, so we need to be really quick, like a lightning exercise. 3 minutes. Yeah, so you should, no, just pick any cards, it doesn't matter, and just try to put them under the categories behind you. Is that clear? So everybody get up, and you're going to take a couple of these cards and try to put them under those headings. Okay, great. There's two more cards back there. Anybody want to take a stab? Okay. So what do we see when we start visualizing it like this? So what does this show you? Now that we have a map of all the barriers and you can visualize it, who can tell me what this tells you as a program manager? Anybody want to take a guess?
I think the most important thing is knowledge and awareness, because so many cards on there. And the second is cause and effort.
Okay, great. So what we're getting here is a prioritization, right? So we start to see we've done a barrier analysis. Okay, we know knowledge and awareness is an important thing. We know cost and effort is a problem. We know there's some issues at point of service, and we have some trust issues. Okay, so already we're saving ourselves some money. Okay, so we're not doing everything across the board. We're just saying we need to do four things, and now we can see what our plan of action is going to be. We start to peel off the layers. Okay? Is this helpful, this framework, to see it like this? Okay, we're going to work more with this framework a little bit more. Thank you. You can all sit down. Yes.
I just want to just talk about this. I mean, this is how we've allocated, this is how we've thought of some of the barriers. But this trust issue, I do think, continues to be a big one, and it's important in terms of trust in the health system, trust in the health worker. I wonder, the way we recognize some of the barriers, maybe we're not actually as aware of some of the trust barriers or not recognizing them as much as we should, given that we've placed most of the barriers around knowledge, cost and effort, and point of service.
So, what is the causality?
Yeah, and that's a good point. So, obviously, when you do this in your countries, you're going to be collecting data from communities. And in order to get the right answers, you have to ask the right questions, right? And I think that's Grace's point. So we might not be asking the right questions about trust, and so the data coming back might not show that there's a trust issue. So it's really important before you start your community investigation or your community data collection that you have a framework, that you know what you're looking for. So this is a helpful start. You might have other things, or there may be other categories beneath here, and you can see, you will have a copy of this presentation, but you can see under trust, there's a lot of categories under trust. So misinformation, that's a category under trust. Trust in the providers, trust in the vaccine. Confirmation bias is something that we didn't really talk about, but it could just be, well, I think that I don't want to do any harm, or that's omission bias. Confirmation bias, maybe I think that the vaccine is, I already have a predisposition to thinking the vaccine is harmful, and so I've asked sources, and they've confirmed it, and so I have that bias. So just to say, you need to know a little bit about what you're looking for, have a model, have a framework, do some quick and dirty formative research to help you understand what you're looking for. So at each of these stages, there's also an outcome. And so how do you measure where you are against this framework? So under knowledge and awareness, for example, when we know that our community has high knowledge and awareness, we say, okay, they understand the value of immunization. They know when and where to receive immunization services. I'm sorry, that's a typo. If they have trust, they have trust in the vaccines, they have trust in the health workers, and they have trust in the system that's providing the vaccines. Intent means that people perceive vaccination positively, they believe the benefits outweigh the risks, and they believe that immunization is considered a social norm. So, there are outcome measures for each of these stages, and it's important to know where you are and what your target is. And so there are certain sources that can help you get this information. You don't always have to do a big knowledge, attitude, and practices study. You could do exit interviews, for example, at the end of a clinic. Were you satisfied with your service? Were you treated respectfully? You could do rapid polls. So it's not going to be representative, but it could be quick, and it could give you a quick sense of what you're looking for. Social media listening, which we talked about. Social media listening is a really good way to understand what the pulse of people's perceptions are. It doesn't cost you anything. It's usually a pretty big sample, even though it may not be representative, and it gives you sort of extremes in the population. So it tells you this is the most extreme part of the population. Those are generally going to be the people on social media. Okay, we're almost running out of time, but I want to talk about a really important perspective, which is empathy. And so oftentimes when we are addressing interventions for minority or vulnerable populations, it's a number or it's a statistic. We say 5% of the population isn't affected or isn't getting services, or 10%, or this ethnic minority. But we talked a lot about getting data, and getting data is a little bit different than understanding and really trying to put yourselves in the shoes of the population that's not getting services or that's not being reached, and really trying to understand why. And this is a very difficult thing to do and to do well. So I'm just going to give you an example. First of all, deep empathy breaks down silos between people, and it provides a sense that we are all connected through shared humanity. And so historically, vulnerable groups are vulnerable for a reason. They're vulnerable because there have been systematic sort of discrimination, or there have been policies, or there has been legislation that has enabled this group to be vulnerable. And sometimes it's by accident, but sometimes it's not by accident. So I'm just going to give you a quick example from Hong Kong. So many of you may have seen the news in Hong Kong. There's a lot of unrest, but this issue around ethnic minorities in Hong Kong has been going on for quite a while, where ethnic minorities who are, you know, sort of first generation born in Hong Kong or new immigrants have said, we don't have the same access to healthcare. And there's been a lot of sort of media around communication between ethnic minorities and health providers. And so these are some headlines. So communication woes between ethnic minority patients and Hong Kong doctors spark a call for better healthcare training. 1 in 5 ethnic minorities say that they're living in poverty. And, you know, a Hong Kong charity reaches out to ethnic minorities who face barriers to healthcare. Do you see headlines like this in your countries? Sometimes, not ethnic minorities, but vulnerable populations, poor populations. Raise your hand if you've seen anything like this in your country or on the news. Okay, only a few. Okay, so that's already a good indication that it's not always something that's very visible, okay? Or it's not always something that gets media attention because it's such a small component of the population. Can you just play this video? So this is a campaign in Hong Kong that has gotten personal stories of different ethnic minorities and how they face discrimination every day. I've just picked one out for you. But it's a really interesting campaign. I can give you the website if you want to look at it. That's the one. There's no sound. Oh, yeah, there you go.
My boss and her daughter inside.
That's meeting, okay.
And then I said, what? I am Marisa Dihito, 37 years old, and I came here in Hong Kong 4 years ago just to support my family. So that time I was in Mong Kok. I was eating in the McDonald's. And then I saw a helper outside, and so I asked her, why you were here? Why are you standing here? And then she said, I was waiting for my boss and her daughter inside eating. And then I said, why you don't go and join with them? And then she said, they don't allow me to eat with them. And then I said, why don't you go home? And then she said, I can't, I need to wait for them. And then I said, do you eat already? And then she said, not yet. And then I said, why don't you go with me and eat together with us? And then she said, cannot, because her boss will get angry. So what she did is she just waiting for the boss until they got finished, and she ate nothing. It hurts seeing them waiting, their boss eating inside, and they were outside eating nothing. It's bad. It's really bad. I mean, it's really bad attitude for the employer. Why it's so hard to be kind? I mean, we're all humans, have feelings. I think for me, it's because the job we have, the country we've been with, or is it because we're just in a low-class level? If the helper is Chinese, I think they will treat nicely because they were same nationality. In this world, if you are from those poor country, really, you are discriminated around the world. See, look at this: India, Sri Lanka, Indonesia, Philippines. If they were so, and then they will always say, Philippines, they just work abroad as a domestic helper. I said, yeah, we work. I mean, we also go to school. We just choose this because of our family. And we're willing to sacrifice for them. Really, it hurts. But what can we do? This is the job. We need a job.
Thank you. So, how does this make people feel? So I can feel the room just went silent. There's a lot of emotion on your faces. Did you have that emotion when I showed you this?
No, I had mentioned yesterday that YouTube is such a powerful, emotive thing that is from a influencing emotions around vaccines is very, I mean, this is a different issue. Actually, what I was thinking of when I was watching this is an issue within a bigger issue right now, which is, you know, the violence on the streets. That's another level of, and when you're already a minority and then you have this other layer of violence, it's not unlike some of the polio situations where you have layers of issues which are barriers.
So we spoke yesterday about how the anti-vaccine movement has leveraged this type of storytelling, but we can also leverage this type of storytelling to understand people and to bring that understanding to other people. So I could have showed you a bunch of data about how ethnic minorities in Hong Kong are discriminated against, but it's very different than showing you a story of somebody talking about their own personal experience. Not somebody talking about their experience for them. It's in her words. Okay, so I told you two stories today. I showed you two stories. Do you remember those stories? So when I asked you to recall facts about those stories, you guys were really good. You remember details like drugs and grandparents and children and what they had for lunch, right? Because it was a story. And people remember stories and people connect with stories. And especially with issues of ethnic minorities and vulnerable populations, you know, we don't always want to connect with those groups. They may be very different. They may feel very foreign. We may feel like there's nothing that bridges those ethnic groups with ourselves or with the lives that we live. But there is something that bridges us, and that's sort of humanity, right? And everybody's sort of shared human nature. So this woman's talking about just wanting to do well for her family. She's just struggling and sacrificing for her family. But people who look at her might just see a domestic worker. So it's really important as you're looking at social data, not just to go and collect data, but to also listen for people's stories and then make those stories, help make those stories be heard. So if you have a minister of health or a minister of finance who doesn't understand why it's important to invest in ethnic minorities, if you put a video like that in front of them, it's maybe a much more effective way for you to understand what to do and for somebody to finance it or to somebody for somebody to prioritize it. Okay? So just really quick, and I hope that maybe we can carry some of this into our activity planning, because my last session was about taking this and designing interventions, but maybe with Heidi's permission, we could sort of use some of this into the in the next session. So I just want to kind of come back to design, and this is maybe getting to a little bit of Lauren's questions, like, what do we do? Okay, we know all these barriers existed. What now? So how did the polio program adapt their demand generation interventions based on the data about minority populations? So I showed you all that data. What did they do about it? So they found out that caregivers wanted to see more female vaccinators. So this white and green is how many people wanted to see female vaccinators, and the green is how many actually saw a female vaccinator. So you can see in Afghanistan, it's a big gap. Like 40% of people weren't seeing the type of healthcare worker they wanted to see at their door. In northern Nigeria, it's a little bit better, but still 10 or 15%. And in Pakistan, it's about 20%. Okay, so right off the bat, if we're looking at this journey here and we see quality of service, okay, well, if we have this data, we know. Okay, what happens when we just change gender? Does that, how much does that increase our coverage? So you can start to be very deliberate about what you do. Trust, compassion, and respectfulness of the vaccinator were the biggest driver of commitment to vaccinate. So these are people who said they trusted the vaccinators, felt vaccinators cared, that they were respectful, and that they were knowledgeable. So these were all parents that were uncommitted to vaccinate every time. They said, I will not vaccinate my child, which is pretty rare for people to say. But you can see how many of them fell in the categories where they did not trust the vaccinator, they didn't feel the vaccinator cared, they didn't feel they were respectful, or that they were knowledgeable. So, you know, when we talk about service and hesitancy, it is a dynamic relationship. It's like very, very iterative. One impacts the other. So what did we do? What did the program do? So before we had this data, we always knew that cases were predominantly among this minority group. For years, they knew, and they still know, that cases, particularly in Pakistan, were among this Pashtun minority population. But no communication, nothing visible, ever invited or involved this group in the communication. So rather than being involved in their own solution, they were sort of victimized. People felt like, oh, these are the Pashtuns. They're carrying the disease. They are the reason that Pakistan has not eradicated it, because all the communication was showing Urdu speakers. They were showing people from every other part of Pakistan saying, vaccinate your children, which the message was, we vaccinated our children. Did you vaccinate your children? And there was a rift between these two parts of the population. So what the program did for the first time is they started to show minority groups on their communication. Not everywhere, because this wouldn't make sense to put a poster like this. These are Pashtun minority populations. It wouldn't make sense to put a poster like this in, you know, Punjab, for example, where nobody speaks Pashtun and nobody is an ethnic Pashtun. But in the areas where these populations were, they started to show, this is our program. We are health workers, we are mothers, we are fathers, and we are also protecting our children. So they had never before been featured in campaigns. It was never in their language before, and so people didn't feel like this program was for them. And when people say they didn't trust the polio vaccinators, it's because they didn't know who these people were necessarily. But once you started to humanize them and say, I'm a polio worker and I'm a father. I'm a polio worker and I'm a mother. I'm a polio worker and I'm a grandmother. You start to humanize them and they start to feel, okay, we have something in common. We know these people, right? But they didn't just do that. They didn't just put advertisements and ads on TV And then what people saw on the ground or in the health clinics was different. They matched what people saw and felt in the health clinics with what people were seeing on TV, so everything was consistent. So on the ground, they recruited 4,000 volunteers, or they changed the volunteers that were already there. They had the local communities select them, so they were automatically sort of trusted because these people picked them themselves. Communities were able to choose. Obviously, it was supervised and there were some quality assurance mechanisms, but for the most part, communities were able to choose their vaccinators. They were female. That was a requirement in the areas that said they wanted female employees. They spoke local dialects, so they didn't seem like foreigners. They were permanent. So the same health worker was there month after month so they could establish a relationship. One of the things that people said was, I get one person this month, and then there's such a high turnover rate, I get the next person another month. I don't know who these people are, and these people don't know my family. So they made sure that they were permanent. And in order to make sure that they were permanent, you know, they paid them on time. A really big problem in a lot of the marginalized communities is health workers are not paid on time. They're paid late. Or they're not paid at all. And these are main breadwinners for their families. And so again, when you talk about empathy, you know, for many, many months in the polio program, the health workers were sort of blamed for the program not working. They're lazy, they don't show up on time, they're not following our instructions. And then when we started talking to the health workers, they said, I make $2 a day. I am the main breadwinner for my family, and I haven't been paid in 4 months. And then we start to ask the polio managers, could you support your family if you haven't been paid in 4 months? Would you be motivated to come to work every day if you were not paid for 4 months? And so you start to understand a little bit more of where people are coming from when you start to put on an empathy hat. They were supervised by an independent structure and made sure that that supervision had some quality assurance. So people in the program were trained how to be better supervisors and how to be more coaches, how to be more mentors. And they were trained to communicate compassionately and respectfully with parents. So I heard a lot of countries over the last few days saying, well, you know, the health workers don't know how to deal with the questions that are coming from parents, so they either ignore them or they yell at them. And that is something that's very, very common because nobody has given them training on how to address the questions. They don't know the right answers. They panic. And that's very understandable. And they were also trained to promote other health practices beyond polio. And this is really important in immunization because we expect GPs or health workers to know about immunization, but we don't expect the people that are working in immunization to also address other people's needs because they have broader needs than immunization. And we're the only people thinking only about immunization. Nobody else thinks that way. They're thinking about their child and everything that child needs. Okay, so my last slide. I think we're just on time. A few principles that I would like you to take into the afternoon where we start thinking about action plans. A few principles that are important for generally when you're designing interventions, but in particular when you're looking at vulnerable populations. Make it easy. These populations are poor, they have difficult lives, they don't have the mental space to do something complicated. Think about your own self when you're stressed and you're busy and you have priorities and somebody asks you to do something really hard. You know, you don't have the mental space for it. So make it as easy as possible for them to get vaccinated. That might mean providing vaccination services at the point of at work so that people can bring their children. It might mean mobile clinics so that people don't have to travel very far. It might mean providing free transportation. Whatever their barrier is, make it easy. Call attention to supportive social norms, like we saw with Michelle. If she saw a lot of people around her that were doing the same things, she was more likely to do it. So in a community that's vulnerable, find a champion, find a grandmother, find somebody that can call to the norm that it's already happening or that it's possible to happen, that they're not going against cultural beliefs or religious beliefs or anything like that, which again goes back to make it easy. Build trust. So think about why there's distrust. And this is really hard because trust is so inextricably linked to politics, to religion, to decades and decades of historical challenges, but try to find on a very local level how you can build trust. And then go beyond cost effectiveness, because interventions for the most vulnerable, or the 5%, they're never going to be cost effective. They're never going to be your cheap solutions. They are the most expensive, the most intensive, but probably your most important if you want to prevent a massive outbreak and if you want to prevent hesitancy from clustering and getting out of control. That's it. Thank you so much. Do you have any questions before we close? I know I'm keeping you from lunch, so I will not be offended if you don't have questions. All right, thank you. Thank you.